In today's episode, we talk with Lars Müller about how SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop can integrate seamlessly with Active Directory, including getting Kerberos tickets. We're also going to talk with the guys from support again for another episode of News from Support. And this is all coming up right now on Novell Open Audio. Welcome to Novell Open Audio, the podcast that connects the Novell user community with what's going on inside and around the Novell universe. I'm your host, Ted Hager. We have no Aaron Quill here today because he's actually taking a week off this week while I record this. And next week, when this goes online, I'll be actually at the SUSE conference in Prague. And this is the SUSE Labs conference I'll be going to. It's just SUSE engineers from various places around the world coming together to share their ideas, what they're working on, set some priorities and goals and things like that. I've been told it's a fantastic conference and I have to go. So at the behest of Egbert Eich and Michael Motz, I am now going to this conference. And that's where I'll be at the time that this hits the air for you. I'll be bringing back some information about that and what's happened there. Our 6-month semi-anniversary listener survey is still online and will be linked from this episode. And while you're listening to this episode, if you have a browser nearby, please take the time to fill out the listener survey if you have not done so already. We'll be announcing winners, closing the survey on the 30th of September, announcing winners right after that. And please jump online. We're getting a lot of great feedback, but we like to get as many people as we can, so we've left the survey open for quite a while. We've received about 115, 120 responses at the time that I recorded this episode, so we're still looking for a lot more responses from people. Thanks very much to all of you who have put in for it so far. To up the ante a little bit, to sweeten the pot, if you thought that maybe this backpack isn't quite enough for you, I didn't tell you what I might put in the backpack, and I'm still not telling you, but I will put some stuff in the backpack, and there will be some cool SUSE Linux stuff and Novell stuff that you'll receive along with the limited edition green backpack that was only given out to Novell employees at the President's Club meeting from 2006. Now, on with the show. Let's check out what we've got first. I think it's going to have to check out what's going on with the guys from support. And now it's time for news from support. Mike, cue the bagpipes.
Ted, I control the bagpipes.
You control the bagpipes.
I control the bagpipes.
What?
Bagpipes? Stop. Bagpipes? Stop. Never forget it, Ted. I control the bagpipes.
Randy!
Let's just move on.
All right, what do you guys got this week?
I got a bunch of tits from support. Randy has one that he wrote, I believe. And I have a little thing that came in from a customer in the last couple of days. It's a little bit interesting. Going through quickly through the TIDs, how to create a cluster resource with a native Linux file system. This is kind of indicative of one of a number of TIDs I found in the last week that doesn't really contain a lot of information. And I love the fact that it says, this document is currently undergoing changes at Novell Technical Support. It should be moved to the official documentation soon. So basically you got a TID that says, watch this space. But it is interesting to look at the title. You can create cluster resources that are native Linux file systems. You don't have to use Novell file systems like NSS.
Okay, and so that one's being built right now?
It's being moved to documentation, but I just love the fact that there's a TID that says there's nothing to offer.
Better than having TIDs that are Bermashave, you know, where you have to go from one TID to the next to get the whole message.
This space for rent.
Exactly.
ZMD is using too much memory. This one I like because of what it gives as the...
ZMD is the Zenworks management daemon on a Linux machine, right?
Yes.
All right.
I just like the way it's worded. The ZMD process is configured to restart if the memory consumption reaches 250 megabytes in RAM. And then it says, the memory setting of 250 megabytes is not suitable for all environments. No comment.
Is that one that's configurable, though? You can actually make it go larger?
It's been reported to engineering, so that would imply that it's not configurable and that it's going to be worked on. I would imagine the solution is going to end up being a configurable feature.
this agent for updates and things like that. This thing has had a few rounds like this, hasn't it? It's had a couple things that have brought it back to engineering and asked for, hey, fix this part, fix that part. No surprise on a memory issue there.
No, and it's fairly common as part of the development process, unfortunately. It goes out, it gets into scenarios that it was just impossible to predict, and someone discovers problems with it, it comes back and it gets fixed. That works a lot better in the open source community, where there's a lot of flow of commentary, of ideas. People are experimenting a lot more, and they have the opportunity to go and look at the source themselves. It's a little harder with the proprietary products. So they go out, they get used, the feedback comes through one place, one time at a one issue at a time, and then gets put into a list of issues, one item at a time. There's much less fluidity. There's much less aggregation of information that happens.
What's next?
Received invalid signal -1, error seen in the NDSD log. This happened
because... The signal was what was the number?
-1.
Of course, old -1.
Yeah, well, that brings up an issue that we might want to talk about. But this one happened because eDirectory 8.7.3 is supported in /9, 64-bit only. And if it's patched, eDirectory's patched to 8.7.3.8. There's no support for eDirectory running on /8 64-bit. So that was the issue here, was that the customer was trying to use eDirectory on /8. Good idea 64. To upgrade anyway. The 2.4 kernel is the one in /8. 2.6, much better kernel.
There are SLES platforms, though, 64-bit SLES platforms on which you can run eDirectory.
That is correct. And that highlights a point that we were discussing before we started here, error codes. And the issue of error 203, what does it mean? That's something that a lot of developers do. It makes it easier to work on your code if you have error 203.
And I assume you guys probably end up getting calls at all levels of support where there is some kind of error like this that comes up, and the customer is saying, I can't look it up online, I can't find it. What does error 203 mean?
That ends up being a big problem for customers because you've got something that takes you nowhere. 203, it's meaningless unless you can go Google out some piece of information on that error code. It's much less common in open source products where messages tend to be specific. Connection failed, which tells you something to go look at. Error 203 makes it a lot easier for, I'm going to say professional developer, but I guess I really mean corporate developer, to make progress on things. Testing in particular, just to buzz through and make error codes something that are easy to look up. But I think it's an issue that's very big and has been for a while.
So having been on eDirectory for a long time and having used eDirectory back when it was, even before Novell Directory Services, it was NetWare Directory Services, I dealt with error codes when I was an instructor teaching classes. And this was always a question for me is, you know, how if it's not online, if you can't look it up, an error code like that, it gets to support. What happens from there? Because eventually we do get decent lists of error codes, but it seems to take a while. So what is the back-end thing that happens within Novell, Randy?
I think those are eventually, those lists are actually made up by support engineers who have interfaced with development on this ambiguous error code, have finally found the developer who wrote that particular snippet of code and said, hey, what does it mean? And then we document it. And then it's finally out there on the web.
So it becomes part of TIDs, and these days eDirectory messages, error codes are pretty much part of the documentation in general.
Often.
This isn't just a Novell thing. This happens in various software companies, correct?
Oh, yes. It's common in the industry. Well, the open source community is a lot less likely to use error code numbers. I don't know why that happens, but it does make it a lot easier for end users to make some progress on problems. If you think about it, if you've got a problem, you see error 604. You don't know what to do to fix it, so you call support. It takes a day or so to get a response, and then finally you find it's Dave's in control of the bagpipes. And instead, if that first error message had been Dave's in control of the bagpipes, then Ted would have known that there was nothing he could do about it. He just had to get Dave in to make the call there.
I was wondering what the 604 was. I guess as a conclusion, though, on that thought on the whole error codes thing, really, if there are developers listening on this, whether you're inside Novell at another company, if you're just an open source developer out there, document your error codes or give us actual real strings, because as end users, the people that actually have to deal with the software, make it work, and know what's going on when it doesn't work, we really end up appreciating it a lot. And it will help Randy from having to document this stuff through the support networks.
Absolutely.
A lot less work. I could live with that.
What other TIDs you got, Dave?
Getting the SLES 10, SLED 10 software updater to work if you use a proxy server. I'm not going to go into the details. Just so that you know, there's a TID out there that describes how to get the software updater for the new Code 10 products to work if you're using a proxy server. The updater will allow you to do online updates of packages, pick up new patches and new releases of various pieces of code, but document there on describing what you do if you have a
proxy
server.
And that's going to be
server.
Huge for people who are doing test lab kind of stuff where they're behind the proxy and they're not going to production, so they have to get beyond that. They need to know how to configure it for updates.
Proxies are still really common in big corporate environments where they have very controlled access to the internet. If you're using SLED 10, you're an end user. So it's something that is going to come up a lot. Another one that I liked, current and peak values in health monitor appear not to be shown correctly. And I liked it because it has a we know better than you comment in it. The server health table on the health monitor screen in Remote Manager, what we call NORM internally.
This is on OES Manager. In this case, correct?
That
Open
is correct,
Enterprise
yes.
Server.
Happens on Linux and NetWare, but there's some confusion for certain values shown under current and peak. It can happen that values listed under current show up being higher than the values shown under peak. That's a little bit weird to look at, but the resolution is, for these items, we determined that this low value is more informative than the real-time high value. So I love the fact that they're effectively doing smoothing of the peaks, but that's just beautiful wording. For these items, we determined that this low value is more informative than the real-time high value. So delete root CAs in YAS2. Several root certificate authorities have been created within YAS2, and some of them need to be deleted. They're stored under a directory, /var/lib/CAM, with the CAM all in caps. To delete it, you can just rm the file, remove the file, delete the file. In SUSE Linux Enterprise Server 10 and SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop 10, SLES 10 and SLED 10, YAST has been extended to allow those to be deleted using YAST. I think that I'm going to make this the last one. System date and time is wrong after starting SLE X10, X being SOD. And it basically gives...
Was that SOD or like screen of death or S or D?
SUSE Linux Enterprise, your choice, 10. And this one gives you a little bit of a description on all of the options you can use to set time on Linux. What it doesn't do is explain the problem. It basically says, we don't know what the problem is, but here are a bunch of things that can set time. It's kind of interesting because it gives you more than just date. It adds things like time zone, the systematic time drift correction, and controlling the hardware clock. So interesting little lesson on what you can do with time on Linux.
And all of these TIDs that Dave's given us will, of course, be linked off of our main Novell Open Audio website, so you'll be able to catch up with any of those. And since we didn't have any critical security updates, we'll just mention that this is being recorded on, what is today? It's the 7th, isn't it?
The 7th of September.
That gives you the what's up until the 7th of September. Now, on to Randy's bits here.
Randy's bits. I just have a piece that was interesting, came up this week, and we found that the documentation was lacking in explanation, in verbosity. So I took a bit of the documentation that we had and some of the internal training information and combined it into a TID that has been released. It's titled How to Configure Bonding on SLES.
So, SUSE Linux Enterprise Server and bonding.
Bonding.
What is bonding besides what we get to do
It's not the group hug, Ted. It's taking network interfaces, multiple network interfaces, physical interfaces, and basically virtualizing them into a single interface.
So interface pooling is what we used to call this, isn't it?
Or on NetWare, we called it load balancing, fault tolerance.
Right.
Yeah, pooling. So it's the same
bonding's
concept.
The term used for this one.
And in Linux, bonding is the term.
You can bind your interface and you can bond multiple interfaces.
You enslave your interface into a bond. And the bond is what then presents itself to your network. And that's what everything communicates with. And then the bonding driver handles all of the either load balancing or fault tolerance. If one interface goes down, it says, oh, this one's down, I'm moving over to the next interface.
All right. Tell us more about the TID.
The TID is hopefully fairly self-explanatory, and I hope I created enough links in there to make it worthwhile. The big thing here is that it's really simple to do. It sounds like it's a fairly complicated and drawn out process, but really there are four steps to it. The beauty of this is, on top of bonding even, you can create VLANs, you can have everything based around this bonded interface instead of your physical interfaces, which that's big use.
And it shows up, so you're saying it shows up as a separate logical interface that
Correct.
The system knows how to use and doesn't need any kind of special kind of APIs or anything to use.
Correct.
It's just using native
yeah.
stuff. That's
yeah.
awesome.
Now, the drawback, or at least at present time, and I wanted our listeners to be able to know this, is that the bonding driver is dependent upon the LAN driver being able to detect a dead link. So, you know, there's a big caution in the TID about the ability of the physical interface driver being able to detect this dead link. It's up to it to say, hey, this link is dead, and therefore then the bonding driver says, okay, fine, I'll switch it over to the next one.
I see.
But there's a big thing there, and it's in production. It's in, you know, engineers all over the world for various interface companies are working on this to get it a little bit more stable, get it working, and so forth.
I guess that's pretty much it, isn't it, guys?
Yeah.
For today.
I guess that's all. Then we get to say that's it for news from support.
Well, that's it for Dave and Randy. And now we turn to our feature interview. And this is with Lars Mueller. And Aaron and I, when we were in Nuremberg, we pretty much ended up taking a walk with Lars every evening as we came back from the beer garden. Somehow we ended there every night. And Lars would tell us the world according to Lars each time. Lars works on the Samba team along with Jeremy Allison, a few other people. And Lars is one of these guys who's just so passionate about what he does. In fact, I think Aaron told a couple episodes back about how there was an engineer who actually made a change inside of some of the code right before our eyes when we had just said, hey, this makes sense to us, why isn't it this way? And he just made the change right then and there. It's just a minor setting within the Samba settings inside Yast, but it was great to actually have somebody that just was like, oh, really? That's how it should be. So this is Lars, and he's going to tell us all about what's going on with Active Directory and how SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop can actually be brought into an Active Directory environment. And from the demos we saw, Lars even showed us things like Kerberos ticket granting and being able to seamlessly log in single sign-on to Outlook web access through the Firefox browser on a SUSE Linux Enterprise desktop after having authenticated to Active Directory. It was just one of the very cool demos. So without further ado, we get into one of our Nuremberg interviews, a little bit audio challenged on it, but I think you'll find the content inside of it really good. All right, some of you have heard in the past how we've talked to Jeremy Allison, and you've heard a seriously passionate engineer working on the Samba project. We've got Lars Mueller in front of us. He's a senior software engineer working on Samba as well. And he's the guy that Jeremy told us, you got to go talk to Lars because he's been working on all the client authentication. So Lars, welcome to Novell Open Audio, and let's start this off. Tell us about you. How did you come to SUSE? What's your role here? Why are you working on Samba? Things like that. And how do you deal with Jeremy Allison?
I started to work with SUSE Linux in the 90s at the university in Göttingen, and we did a huge deployment of diskless client systems. And so I've been a beta tester of SUSE for a long time. And in 2000, I started to work for SUSE in the business support department. Soon I got involved to ensure that Samba packaging into the Samba packaging at SUSE. maybe 1 year later, I got responsible for the Samba packaging at SUSE and got involved by SIS to several business products from SUSE. And so at the end, I got employed as an engineer to this SUSE server technologies team, where we worked on products like standard server or SLUX. I think it's now mostly a year ago that me and Günter Deschner had been moved to the SUSE Labs department. And so Günter is one of the Novell Samba team members beside Jeremy Ellison. What we talk about today about the integration thing is mostly the work of Günter Deschner. And so he is the authentication guy Jeremy already mentioned in the interview to you. That's my involvement in. And in 2005, I also got a Samba team member at the project. Yeah. So.
All right. So you're actually part of the Samba.org site. In fact, I think we have a link to share with people for your actual page on Samba.org. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right.
Yes.
So we'll put that on the show notes. Let's start our conversation about the Samba side of things, not even about SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop, but let's talk more generally. A lot of people have this concept that it's really all about just getting users authenticated and logged in so they can get at file shares. For those of us who know what enterprise administration space is, when you deal with Active Directory, you're dealing with a much larger system than just simple users and passwords. You got to get into things like workstations in the tree. You got to get into things like Kerberos. Can you give us a little bit of a layout of what is the whole big challenge for getting other operating systems besides Windows so that they can work against a Active Directory backend?
Yes, so the holy grail of Active Directory is this single sign-on thing. Yeah, so you have the integration of the directory and the Kerberos technology. So you might think that that's something which is available in open source too. So why do we care about this? So I think it's really important to provide the same user feeling to our customers with our products. So at the end, there should be the same seamless integration of a Linux client system, even in Microsoft Active Directory environments, as you get with Windows 2000 or Windows XP systems.
So when we talk about seamless integration, what we're saying is when my Linux workstation initially comes up and I'm asked for that username and password, I'm really giving it my Active Directory username and password, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And not only this, so the password is only one thing. It's the first step. So think about the policy stuff you have. Yeah, just about the policies of a password here, or the complexity of a password, the history of a password, the expiration of the passwords. Yeah. So imagine you're a time worker and you should only be allowed to work in the first 4 hours of the day, but not in the afternoon or opposite. Yeah. So what we like to see is following all this stuff even with a Linux client. So as soon as we do this, CIO will accept a Linux client getting integrated in an existing environment.
So the Linux client follows all the policies that I've set up in Active Directory. So if I've said the first time the person logs in, they must change their password, and when they're prompted to change the password, it's got to be 8 characters. They're forced into the having an 8-character password, as well as those temporal constraints that the administrator may have set up. Right?
Yes, so that's really mandatory requirement for us. If we don't follow these restrictions and these policies set by the administrator, we might be seen as an insecure operating system here. And therefore, as you mentioned, we follow these policies here. So if the user must change the password, he get a prompt. Please enter a new password. If he used this password before, he get informed, sorry, this password is in your history.
So really what we're doing is on the Linux workstation, we're making the exact same calls that a Windows workstation would make to the Active Directory server.
Yeah, and that's the magic we worked in the last time.
But even more so on that, it's not just about making the calls, because the calls are an easy part, but it seems like that last mile thing where users are logging in and it doesn't allow you to log in, but you don't get told why on a lot of operating systems. Lars, you're saying that this actually presents the interface and tells the user you didn't get to change your password because it didn't match the quality of password.
There weren't enough characters in it or what have you.
Yeah, so this is actually an interface similar to what the Windows login would look like.
Yeah, so one thing is a technology that's close to the ground, but the other side is when we are closer to the customer, to the user, there must be a graphical feedback somehow, and we must transport the information we got, and not only transport, we must somehow map the information we got to the user. So imagine you're talking to Active Directory and you got a Kerberos error message here, but we have to mangle this somehow to get it into the Linux infrastructure we use for authentication.
So now you mentioned Kerberos, and that really leads up to my next question, because right now, or up until this point, we've only talked about authentication. We've just talked about logging into the workstation. But to really participate in Active Domain, I really need to have the ability to digest those Kerberos tickets and to be able to hand those tickets off to other services when I want to consume other resources, when I want to go access the Samba share that actually resides on a Windows server. Do you have the ability to interact with Kerberos directly so I'm not constantly prompted for usernames and passwords?
Yeah, so that was a requirement for what we worked on in the last half year, that we like to seamlessly integrate in this single sign-on infrastructure. I knew we achieved this. So what we do is we log in, provided username and password against the domain where we are part of, and then we get an initial ticket granting ticket. We don't ask the user, please type your password to get a ticket granting ticket. So it's just done in the background.
So and just to make sure, the ticket granting ticket, that is the key. Once you're authenticating into Samba, or once you're authenticating into Active Directory, I should say, that ticket granting ticket is the key that's going to get you any service tickets for authentication, correct? Mm-hmm. So having that or not having that makes or breaks the single sign-on experience, either on Windows or any other platform trying to get into Active Directory.
Yes, you're true. That's the case here, and that's what we achieved here. So you log in, and you get a ticket granting ticket. And from this point, every service which is Kerberized and every application we use on the Linux side which is Kerberized can work with this ticket granting ticket and get service tickets and work with the service ticket. So you are no longer prompted to enter your username and password.
Now, before the interview, you showed us a cool example as well. You actually gave us this full demonstration. We're going to try to put some screenshots online for this show. But you showed us the actual authentication to an Exchange server through a browser, and that seamless authentication. You didn't get prompted for a password because it was part of the same domain, and you showed us how it gave the service ticket up. So that was a smooth experience right there. How far along are we in the integration of things like browsers and things like that? Give us a little idea of how much that integration is there.
Yeah, the good thing is that Kerberos is nothing which was introduced in the last half year. So Kerberos is there for a long time. Therefore, applications like Firefox, KDE's Conqueror, are already Kerberized, and they are already able to use the infrastructure. So I showed to you just with a browser to access the Outlook web access, and we then used our TTT to get the service ticket, and it works. This even works on other applications. For example, you are using your mail user agent, which is Kerberized here, and even on this level, this works. So you're doing POP3 or IMAP with Kerberos protocols. The integration depends on how well the applications are programmed, and that's what we are still working on to ensure that a user is not asked, should I really trust this domain or not? So what we like to achieve is that the applications just knew we are part of this Kerberos reel, and we then use our tickets.
So being part of the Kerberos realm, the thing that's really cool there then is so many Unix applications that already exist, as well as Linux-based applications. Many of those are already Kerberized, and part of what Novell's doing now is looking at, okay, what other applications do we have to add this Kerberizing into? So this is really kind of laying out the thing that both Windows and Linux clients now get this full single sign-on experience by the work you've been doing.
Yeah, so the good thing is a lot of the applications are already Kerberized, or the applications are using libraries which are Kerberized. And there we are again with Samba. So we have libsmb client, which is part of the Samba project. And this library is Kerberize. So every application using Sys library to access the file server uses the Kerberos infrastructure. There is no difference if the application is Nautilus or if the application is Conqueror or whatever.
So what that really means is there's no difference whether I choose to run KDE as my desktop or GNOME as my desktop. I get the same experience.
You get the same experience here. So, and the good thing is, while working on this project, you know, we had conversations and discussions with both desktop teams, both desktops here. And the good thing is we really had a good relationship here. So we worked on the display managers to get this stuff integrated here. They are both on the same level here. So then when we talked before about error messages coming from the directory, they are displayed with both display managers. So you get a feedback while logging in here. At the next level, we even had the same, we had discussions if the user uses the desktop here for printing and other stuff to get this working as smooth as possible.
Now, one of the things that impressed me most when you were doing that demonstration for us before this interview was how easy it was to install and configure it on the actual workstation. Can you kind of describe to me the process if I've got a brand new SLED desktop, what I need to do to make it part of a domain?
Yeah, so that's something we take care here about. Here. So as mentioned before, it's one thing to have the technology, and the other thing is getting this technology usable by as much people as possible. So what we did is we have integrated as much as possible in Yast. So you start an installation, as known, it's a graphical user interface, and at the end, one of the last steps is you are asked for which authentication source you will use. And beside a local context, etc/ passvd, etc/ shadow, we have now accessing directory or using Microsoft Windows domain. And after you selected it, you get in the next dialog. And in, as part of this dialog, you select which domain you will be part of.
One of the things that impressed me about the types of questions you were asking during that configuration process was the questions were really geared towards people who are familiar with Windows and who are used to setting up Windows Workstation. So all the terminology and everything was really set up for them to understand instead of being cryptic Linux type things.
Yeah, so I think it's for old Linux geek here, he will even understand this. But the old Linux guys, they might use the command line tools. But for us, it is really important that people who come from the Windows world find words they knew. So I believe that makes things much easier to them.
The thing I find interesting about that is, having done administration and having taught network administration, knowing so many people who do actual enterprise networks and things like that from brain shares of many years past, we always have this constant complaint that we share, which is most software companies understand either making the user's experience really good and seamless, and then it sucks for the administrator because they didn't get that part done. Or the other side is, if the administrator has an easy administrative experience, the end users are left with, great, it's all configured, but I can't use it. They don't even know things are there. So it sounds like what you've done here is you've really actually done both sides of the equation on Linux. But one thing I think that I really want to come out in our conversation with you here for our listeners is this means now you've got domain membership, workstations, you've got workstations joining the domain and this seamless experience here. So they actually look inside of Active Directory tools. They actually show up as workstations there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So what many people from the Linux side don't know about is how important this trust relationship between the client system and the server system is. So with the help of this trust relationship, all the authentication stuff is encrypted. So we really have a secure environment. And that's the reason why we introduced these really strange host names, default host names with SUSE 10.1. In former times, we just used Linux as suggestion. But imagine what happened if you have 3, 4, 10, 100 hosts named Linux and they all join the domain. So they create a computer account on the directory server named Linux.
So they all have a similar common name, but their globaling IDs have to be different or else they can't be part of it. So, yeah.
And that's why we have this suffix nowadays. So Linux dash something, I think it's 4 characters, yeah?
Yeah, just some random characters.
Yeah, and we try to ensure that we create a unique host name, yeah? So as soon as an administrator thinks, oh, sys looks crappy, yeah, and he removes the letters, he will run an issue, yeah, but by default, it works.
Now, the phrase that we have in English for that is that's idiot-proofing. It's keeping somebody from just being, from when they just click through things, it automatically generates the characters so that they don't do something stupid. We help them not do that.
Yeah.
But the most administrators probably want to name their workstations a unique name that they determine, not a unique name that we automatically generate, the skilled administrators. Do we have a way that they can do that, that if I want to name the workstation rather than have the software do it automatically?
Yeah, sure. It's a must. So if you like to name your workstation FUBAR, it's your way. You go.
I understand from Saving Private Ryan that FUBAR is actually a German word, too. So, great. We really appreciate you joining us and giving us this quick overview. So, thank you very much for joining us, Lars.
And, yeah, thanks a lot.
We'll be talking to you again because this is, I know, a topic that is very big among our enterprise administrators. They want to bring in Linux machines to the Windows network, and we want to help them. So, can we come back and maybe talk to you in a couple months to find out how things are progressing, some areas you and Jeremy are working on?
Yeah, sure. You're welcome. So, I hope we will do further progress, and there are a lot of items we can work on. Yeah, so I think in half a year we have good news to you too.
Right on. Thanks very much, Lars.
Thanks,
You're
Lars.
You're welcome.
And that's pretty much a wrap for this episode of Novell Open Audio. We got a couple things coming up on the horizon. I've put in a bid to go to Ohio Linux Fest. So if there's anybody that's actually in the Ohio area that's one of our listeners and you're coming to Ohio Linux Fest, please come up and say hello to me. I'm hoping that I'll have a session there at Ohio Linux Fest. And with that, we'll remind you that Novell Open Audio is a production of Novell Users International in conjunction with Novell Incorporated, and all of our content is actually guided by our listening community. We're getting our listener survey feedback right now. We've got a bunch of ideas already from people's comments that they've put on the survey. So please fill out the survey. You can also rate each episode that we have, and you can also leave comments on a per episode basis. You can even tell us what questions you want us to ask of people coming up. And I will mention one other thing, and that is we haven't had a whole lot of listener requests or that we've been honoring anyway on the show. We've had all this coverage about SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop and SUSE Linux Enterprise Server. We're going to get back onto our regular scheduled programs within a few more interviews. We've got a few more things from Nuremberg to get out there for you, and then we'll start covering a whole bunch of other stuff as well and taking those listener subject requests and starting to handle some of those as well. So with that, that's pretty much our entire episode for you. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.